Okay. So last class, we had a video that covered off the basics of marketable permits. And today we're going to extend that model. And we're going to be looking at first Kolstad. Chapter 14. Only section one. Okay, and section one covers issues around space, where section two looks at issues over time, and we will not be looking at that section of the chapter at all. Okay. But before we get in there, we're going to have a bit of a digression and look at a review of some math. Now, after we look at Kolstad, we are going to look at the two papers that are on the reading around cap and trade. And when you're reading those papers, you're going to come across some math notation. And I just want to clarify when you see it to make sure that it makes sense to you and you can follow along. And it's actually not as difficult as it may appear. So let's take a look-see at it and see where we get. Okay. So we're going to look at two items, two background. Topics. Or just first is going to be some basics of matrix algebra. And the second is what's known as the Kuhn-Tucker conditions. Which is inequality constraints. Okay. Okay. So let's consider a simple case where I give you an equation that says y is equal to 12 minus 2x and y is equal to, say, 3 plus 2x. So here we have two equations, two unknowns, and we can graph them. And if we put x and y, we get actually, I am going to change this from 3 to 4. So the first equation has a vertical intercept of 12 and a horizontal intercept of 6. Okay. And it's written in slope intercept form, which is the y equals a plus bx, where a equals the intercept and b equals the slope. Second equation is going to be vertical intercept of 4 and also a slope of 2. And minus 2. Okay. So these are two equations, two straight line equations written in slope intercept form. Okay. Okay. Now I'm going to rewrite them as 2x plus y equals 12 and negative 2x plus y equals 4. So these are the exact same equations. Nothing's different, but this is what's known as the general form of a straight line. So all I've done is transform them into a new form. Otherwise, they are absolutely completely identical. Now, if you notice that I have the x's first and the y's second, and that's important for what's about to happen next. Now, what I can do is I can write these in a third form, which is known as matrix form. And matrix algebra, matrix form, looks something like this. Okay. And these boxes represent matrices and vectors. In the first box, I take the coefficients as they appear. So we have a 2, minus 2, and in front of the y's, we'd be just 1. So I'd write that as 2, negative 2, 1, and 1. The second column there is a vector, which has the two variables, x and y. And on the other side, the equal sign is the vector of constants. So this is known as a 2x2 matrix. This is a 2-row by 1-column vector. And so is this. Okay. So this is the exact same equations, pair of equations, except now they're written in matrix form as opposed to general form or opposed to slope-intercept form. Now, some of you may have taken a matrix algebra course and learned about manipulating such equations and using things like Cramer's rule or matrix inversion to solve them. That's not necessary here. What I really want you to do is to become familiar with this notation, since it's going to be used in some of the papers we read. So in general, we can write an equation as a11x1 plus a12x2 equals d1. The a11, the a12 are coefficients, just like the 2 and the 1 in the first equation. a21x1 plus a22x2 is equal to d2. So aij are just coefficients. And the di is just a constant. So in the above, we have coefficients 2, negative 2, 1, and 1, and constants 12 and 4. So I take this and I write it in matrix form. And I have all the a's, which are the coefficients, with their subscripts. And the x's with their subscripts. And the d vector of constants with their subscripts. Now, matrix algebra, you're familiar with if you've ever played around in Excel. So a matrix is like a spreadsheet. Okay, and Let's just. Gonna open one up. Okay. So here we have simply an Excel spreadsheet, and we notice that we have column A, column B, column C. We have row 2, row 3, and so on. So if I click in this cell, it is cell D. So I'm in column D, and it's in row 7. And if I look up here, I see that in the corner, I have the D and the 7. Okay, so each box represents, each cell represents a certain address in the spreadsheet. And that is exactly the same as what goes on in a matrix. And over here. Okay. So when we look at a matrix of coefficients, we see that the A11 corresponds to the location in the first row and the first column. So A11, first row, first column. And A12 is first row, second column. And as we go through the matrix, each address represents a location in the matrix. And the vector beside it is the vector of unknowns, and they coincide with how they appear in the equation. So X1 appears first, X2 appears second. Okay, now, then we have the D vector. So the purpose of this is that matrix algebra is an alternative to the normal algebra you have learned in high school. And it's particularly good for large systems of equations. So an example would be to say we have A11 x1 plus A12 x2 plus dot 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 A1n xn equals D1, and this carries on down to plus AN2X2 plus ANNXN, and that equals EN. So if we have a system of equations that are 10, 20, 30, 40 variables, then we can write it in matrix form, A11, AN1, A1N, ANN, as such, and we have our vector x1 xn equals the vector d1 through dn. Okay. So in matrix algebra, what is convention is to give each of these matrices and vectors a name. So we will call the coefficient of the matrix of coefficient, which is n rows and n columns, we'll just call it A. And we'll call the vector of unknowns x1 through xn, x, with no subscript. and the vector of constants D. So I can write this entire large system of equations as AX equals D. And this is in matrix form. And I know, if I'm familiar with matrix algebra, that the big A means a big A refers to this box of coefficients. The X refers to a vector, and the D refers to a vector. Okay. So, when you're reading papers on cap and trade, then you will see this form of notation throughout the paper, and it simply is a shorthand that allows us to write large systems of equations in a nice compact form. So what will happen is when we get to the papers by Krubnitz, Oates, and Vandenberg, and McGartland and Oates, the 83 and the 85 paper, you will see this type of notation. You do not know how, have to know how to do any matrix manipulation other than recognize that it is just simply a large system of equations written in a compact form. Okay. So, okay. Now, what we're going to look at next is what's called Boone-Tucker. Okay. So, in management science, there is what's known as linear programming. And then there is what's known as nonlinear programming. And nonlinear programming is where we get the work of two mathematicians, Kuhn and Tucker, who developed models that are useful, especially in economics. So let's see how that works. So the most common form is maximizing utility. Subject to a constraint. Okay. So let's suppose that we have u equals x times y, and our constraint is x plus y equals 10. Okay. So graphically, we can set up this problem. We have x, we have y, and the constraint is simply the budget line. Oops. Grab the wrong shape there. That looks like this. And we know that there are indifference curves that travel out from the origin, u0, u1, u2. And that when the indifference curve is tangent to the constraint, we get our solution. And we can set up the Lagrange to solve this problem, and the Lagrange would be x times y plus lambda times 10 minus x minus y. We take the first order conditions, del sub y equals. And finally, the lambda gives us back 10 minus x minus y. And we can tell from the first two equations that x equals y. Goes to the third equation, we get 10 minus 2x equals 0, x equals 5, y equals 5, and we get the solution. And the utility is 25. So what we're going to do is ask the question, what happens if we add a second constraint? Okay. So let's take our original problem. So we have the first constraint. Which is x plus y equals 10. But now we're going to change it and say, actually, the constraint is x plus y must be no greater than 10. Now that has always been true in consumer theory, but we've also made the assumption more is preferred to less, which always guarantees that the consumer is on their budget line, not inside their budget line. Okay. So then we're going to add a second constraint, that x must be less than or equal to x bar. So then we can put that constraint in. Say, so now we want to maximize utility, except we want to be inside this budget line, on or inside the budget line, but no greater than x bar. So this region becomes what we call the feasible set. Okay. So we know that without the X bar constraint, that x star equals y star equals 5. So the question becomes, if, for example, x bar is greater than 5, then we know that without that constraint, our consumer would have chosen x star equal to 5. So that extra constraint that x is less than, x cannot be greater than x bar, would said to be it doesn't matter. Or it would be then it's a non-binding constraint. But if x is less than 5, x bar, then we have an interesting problem. Because in our example, without the constraint, we had an answer at point A, where X was 5 and Y was 5. And let's suppose that X bar is 4. So now we have a second constraint that is here, and our solution lies outside our feasible set. So this represents the feasible set, and we know that in the absence of the second constraint, the indifference curve was here. So now what happens? Well, we have to go to the highest indifference curve subject to that constraint. And if X is 4, then Y will be 6. Utility will be 24. So the binding constraint pushes us from A back to B. Okay. So that is an simplest example of having two constraints. So let's take this problem a little further. Let's suppose that we had u equals x times y. We wanted to maximize u equals xy subject to X plus Y is less than or equal to 100, and 2X plus Y is less than or equal to 120. So now we have two constraints that are linear. So before we do any math, the first thing we want to do is check and see what this looks like. So we graph it, and we see that first constraint looks like this, 100 and 100. And the second constraint goes from 120 to 60. So I can see that these two constraints cross. So depending on where I am, I either could be on trapped by the blue line or trapped by the red line. So if I was trying to maximize utility subject to these two constraints, then I could be in one of three places. I could be at the kink, A. I could be just on the blue line, B. Or I could be just on the red line, C. So if I'm at point A, then I would say both constraints are binding. If I'm at point B, only 100 equals X plus Y is the binding constraint. And if I'm at point C, only 120 equals 2X plus Y is binding. Okay. Now, this is where the Kuhn-Tucker analysis comes in. How do we figure out and solve this particular problem? Now, if at point B, the blue line, X plus Y equals 100, is binding, then we say the red line, x equals, or 2x plus y equals 120, is non-binding. And similarly at C, 120 equals 2x plus y is binding, so 100 equals x plus y is not binding. So the Kuhn-Tucker approach. So the Kuhn-Tucker is a type of Lagrange. So we set up our Lagrange and we will use x plus utility equals x times y. So the Lagrange says we maximize x, y subject to 100 minus x minus y, the first constraint. And I'm going to call that lambda 1 because that represents the first constraint. Then I'm going to add a second constraint, lambda 2 times 120 minus 2x minus y. Okay. So now I have a Lagrange equation with two constraints. So the way we solve this is we go in what's known as step by step. And actually implicit in this is two other constraints. Also, x must be greater than or equal to zero. Y must be greater than or equal to zero. So this is our non-negativity constraint. So that limits the problem in the top first quadrant in a four quadrant graph. So we cannot go with x less than zero or y less than zero. And so our entire feasible set is here. Now, the Kuhn-Tucker approach is actually fairly simple. So what we do is we say step one, try setting lambda 2 equal to 0. Now, when you set lambda 2 equal to 0, that is the mathematical way of saying the second constraint doesn't matter. So if lambda 2 is 0, 0 times anything is 0, the whole second constraint disappears. So then the Lagrange becomes x times y plus lambda 1, 100 minus x minus y. We take the derivatives with respect to x and y, and lambda 1. And we set them equal to 0. And from the first two equations, we get that x equals lambda, y equals lambda. I divide the first equation by the second, and I get x over y equals 1, or x equals y, which goes to the third equation, and I get 2x equals 100, x equals 50, y equals 50. Okay. So that is the solution if the only constraint was the blue one. So now that I have ignored constraint number 2 and I've got an answer, I go back and check the second constraint. So I've made an assumption that I can ignore the second constraint, and that the answer, what I'm assuming is that we're going to get an answer like point B. We're on the blue line inside the red line. So I go back and I know that 2x plus y must be less than or equal to 120. So 2 times 50 plus 50 has to be less than or equal to 120. That's 150, which is greater than 120. And therefore, my assumption fails. So my assumption that lambda 2 is 0 was incorrect. So step 2. Try lambda 1 equal to 0. All right, little problem with the screen here. Okay, so if I try lambda 1 equal to 0, then the Lagrange becomes L equals xy plus lambda 2 times 120 minus 2x minus y. So then I take the first order conditions. First with respect to x, then respect to y. And then with respect to the Lagrange multiplier. And see what answer I get. So from the first two equations, I get that y equals 2 times lambda 2, x equals lambda 2. I divide the first equation by the second. The lambda 2s cancel, and I'm left with y over x equals 2, or y equals 2x. This I substitute into the third equation, and I get 120 minus 4x equals 0, x equals 120 over 4 equals 30, and y equals 60. So that is the utility maximizing outcome if I ignore the first constraint. So now I test the first constraint to see if my assumption was correct. So I know that x plus y must be less than or equal to 100. So I have 30 plus 60 less than or equal to 100. That's 90 less than or equal to 100. Therefore, this one passes. Okay. Now, once I have a solution that works, then stop. I don't have anything left to do. However, if both assumptions x lambda 1 equals 0 and lambda 2 equals 0 fail, then the solution is where two constraints intersect. Okay, so let's look at this one more time. Okay, so we have x and we have y. So we initially assumed that only constraint one mattered. So we put in constraint number one, 100, 100, and we got the answer that x equals 50. And y equals 50. So that was our answer. Call that A. Right? Let lambda 2 equals 0. So we ignored the second constraint. Then we put in the second constraint to see if this answer A was inside or outside the constraint. Now, if this answer had been out here, then we would have stopped because A is inside the red constraint. But so what we found instead was that the constraint was actually sitting here. So point A is actually outside the second constraint of 120 and 60. So then we ignored the blue constraint. And said, well, what would happen if we simply took out the blue constraint? And looked at the red constraint. So we maximize utility and found that the answer we got was 60 and 30. So that is point B. Then we went back and put the blue constraint back in to see if we satisfied that constraint, and we see that point B is inside the blue line. So therefore, that is a perfectly valid constraint. And it's a valid assumption that lambda 1 equaled 0. So if we maximize utility subject to the red line, we get to point B. That means that the second constraint does not influence the outcome when we choose only from the first constraint. If that point had failed, then we would have gone to point C. And that would have been the answer. But in this case, because of the way the indifference curves work, the first answer we got was here. And that was U1. The second answer we got was here. And that is the answer that's the highest indifference curve that satisfies both constraints. Now, if that one had failed, then we would have been in at point C. So, okay. So if we consider a case where we have, let's draw this one more time. Okay. Oops, sorry, hang on one second. So we could have had the situation where we had the following situation where this was the first constraint and Oops. This is the second constraint. And we maximize utility subject to only the blue line, and we get the indifference curve is here at A. So we ignore that and we maximize utility, and we get the answer at B. Well, A and B are both outside of the other constraint. So in that case, we would say that both, assuming both lambda one and lambda two zero failed, that means the final answer would have to be at C. So that would give us, we'd say that given that neither constraint can be ignored, we must do it where we have just the two constraints crossing. So we're going to use that approach when we are looking at what is called the cap and trade model. Okay, so just hang on 1 second. And I just have to correct something. So if you just give me a minute. Okay, so this is what's known as the Kuhn-Tucker approach. And we're going to come back to that in a little while. Okay, so let's get back and start looking at chapter 14, Kohlstedt. Okay, so our basic model has said that if we had emissions E and firms had their marginal savings functions, and we were to allow them to trade, then they would buy permits at the permit price up to the point where the marginal savings equals the permit price. And if it's the optimal permit price, then we will get the right level of emissions based on the number of permits issued in the market. However, this model assumes that one unit of emissions equals one unit of pollution. Okay. And what we're going to do is we're now going to relax that assumption. Okay. So what we're going to look at is the situation where we have firm one and we have firm two, and each one produces emissions E1, E2, and together they lead to P, which will be our pollution. Except the impact of each firm's emissions will differ. So in the case of firm one, for example, it may be that every time they produce one unit of emissions, it does two units of pollution. So their impact is 2 to 1. Firm two, on the other hand, their impact may be that one unit of emissions causes 3 units of pollution. So the total impact of one unit of each firm polluting is 5 pollution from one unit of each firm. If firm one increases their emissions by one, then the pollution goes up by two. If firm two increases their emissions by one, then pollution goes up by three. And let's suppose that, for example, if firm one was producing five and firm two is producing five, then total emissions would be 2 times 5 is 10 plus 3 times 5 is 15. So pollution would be 25. And if firm two was to reduce their emissions by 1 to 4, and let firm two increase their emissions by 1 to 6, then we get 4 times 2 is 8 plus 6 times 3 is 18. That means pollution goes to 26. So a one-for-one trade between firms one and two causes pollution to actually go up if they trade from firm one. Firm one reduces their emissions and firm two gets to increase their emissions, okay? So this is what happens when we introduce space. Depending on where firms are located, so we have firm one and they produce E1, and firm two, they produce E2. And firm one, pollution comes out of firm one, and within a certain distance, they have a level of damage. Then, as you get further away, the level of damage goes down, and further away, the level of damage, say, goes down. So it may be that the first layer or ring is 3. So one unit of emissions does 3 units of damage. If you're below the first ring, but inside the second ring, the damage is 2. And if you're in the outside the second ring, but inside the third ring, the damage is 1. So depending on where you're located, so if you live at a house that's here at X1, then your damage is 3. If you're at X2, your damage is 2. And if you're at X3, your damage is 2. If you're out here at X4, your damage is only 1. If you're over here at X5, your damage is only 1. However, we have a second firm, and their damage starts off similar to the first firm. So here we have the first ring, and it does damage of 3. Then we have the second ring, and it does damage of 2. And then we have the third ring, and it does damage of 1. So we have 3, 2, 1. So now we have to look at each address and see what's going on. So if I'm at, say, X3, I'm getting 2 units of pollution from firm 1, 1 unit of pollution from firm 2. So therefore, my damage is 3. So I get 3 units of damage right here. Now, at house X2, we see they get 2 units of damage from firm 1, but nothing from firm 2. So their damage is only 2. So even though they're both X2 and X3 are affected the same way by firm 1, X2 and X3 are affected differently by firm 2. Also, if we look at X1 and compare it to X3, we notice that they both get 3 units of damage, except X1 gets 3 units of damage from firm 1 and nothing from firm 2. And X3 gets 2 units of damage from firm 1 and 1 unit of damage from firm 2. So this introduces the problem of spatial differences between firms and households that receive the impact of the emissions or pollution from these firms. And this is what we're going to look at. So, Kolstad. The basic model starts off this way. We are going to have, let I equal 1 to big I of emission sources. We'll let J equal 1 to big J of pollution receptors. So receptors measure the level of pollution. So they also represent zones. So wherever we set up a receptor, that means we are looking at the level of pollution within a certain zone. We'll let EI equal the emissions from source I. So this is the firm that's polluting. So there's source I. We will let AIJ represent the transfer coefficient. Which is the represents the damage at J from a unit of I. So the transfer coefficient represents the amount of damage 1 unit of emissions from firm I does at receptor J. So up in our example up here, this is, let me call this P1. This is say A11, and this is A21. So the transfer coefficient for firm 1 is 2. The transfer coefficient for firm 2 is 3. Okay. Now, we'll let PJ equal the pollution measured in terms of ambient quality at receptor J. Okay. So when we take a receptor J, it is equal to the pollution from firm 1 times their transfer coefficient plus A2J E2. So A2J represents the impact of firm 2 on receptor J. And this carries on up to A big I. So that's the last Source of pollution or emissions, big I. J, receptor J, times E, big I. And then we add on B, sub J. And B, J, represents background pollution. So if none of our sources were putting out emissions, there would still be some pollution registered at our receptor simply by the fact that you cannot have human beings living somewhere without some sort of air quality degradation. Okay, and so we refer to the background pollution as BJ, and we can write this in a more compact notation as this equals the sum of I equals 1 to big I of Aij times Ei plus Bj. So that measures the pollution at any receptor. And to make life simple, we'll let Bj just simply be zero for now. So that way we don't have to worry about the background pollution. Okay. So let's consider the 2x2 case. So we have two firms, two zones. Okay. So we can write out this problem as A11E1 plus A21E2, and that equals P1. And we have E1 plus A22E2 equals P2. And remember earlier we talked about how we would write this in matrix notation. So we have A11, A21, A12, A22 times E1, E2 equals P1, P2. Okay, and therefore the matrix of coefficients is sometimes referred to as the transfer matrix, and it captures all the elements in the transfer matrix, captures all the different ways different pollution sources impact different receptors or different zones. And also known as the diffusion matrix, because it measures how pollution emissions diffuse throughout the system and have an impact. Okay. Now, if we look at these equations, so let's look at equation one, for example. Okay, so we said equation one was A11E1 plus A21E2 equals P1. So then we know that A11 times the change in E1 plus A21 times the change in E2 will equal the change in P1. So we can see a linear relationship. So if E1 gets bigger by 1 times A11 and E2 gets bigger by 1 times A21, we add it up to get the change in P1. Now, let's let the change in P1 equal 0, meaning we're going to hold the level of pollution in zone 1 constant. So that gives us that A11 change in E1 plus A21 times the change in E2 equals 0. Or if we take it to the other side, we can write this as A21 change in E2 equals the negative of A11 times the change in E1. Divide through by the change in E1 and divide through by A21, and we get the change in E2 from a change in E1 is equal to the negative A11 A21. Okay, so this represents a form of marginal rate of substitution. This is the ability. This says that the rate of change of E1 to E2 that holds pollution in zone 1 constant is equal to the ratio of the transfer coefficients. Okay, that will become important a bit later on. Okay, so now let's go back. Now we look at the change in, A11 times the change in E1 plus A21 times the change in E2 equals the change in P1. If we let the change in E2 equals 0, then we know that the A11 times the change in E1 equals the change in P1, or the change in P1 from a change in E1 is simply A11, the transfer coefficient, which is the partial derivative dP1 dE1. Okay. Now, let's look at the notion of the marginal damage and marginal savings. Okay, so we're going to create and define MDEI as equal to, by definition, the marginal damage of emissions from I. Okay. Now we're going to define the marginal damage of pollution, PJ, as the marginal damage of pollution. At J. Okay. Now, the link between the marginal damage of emissions and the marginal damage of pollution is as follows. The marginal damage of emissions from Fermi is equal to Aij times the marginal damage of pollution at J. Okay. So what we're interested, we know that there is a damage caused by pollution, but we want to link it back to the firm, and it says that the damage done is in terms of a unit of emissions. So if one unit of emissions does leads to Aij times worth of damage, then the damage of one unit of pollution times Aij is how much damage the emissions did by firm I. So let's suppose that the marginal damage of Pj was equal to 3 times Pj. So one unit of pollution does $3 worth of damage. Further, let Aij equal 2. So that means that one unit of Ei leads to 2 units of Pj. And the marginal damage is going to be 3 per every unit of Pj. So the damage will equal 6. So one unit of E leads to 2 units of Pj, which therefore, if each unit of P does $3 of damage, one unit of emissions does $6 of damage. Okay. Now, so before we said that for efficiency, we needed the marginal savings of firm one equals the marginal savings of firm two equals the marginal damage. Okay, once we introduce this problem of space and transfer coefficients, then the formula changes to be the marginal savings of firm one over A11 has to equal the marginal savings of firm two over A21 equals the marginal damage of P1. So now what we're doing is we are adjusting the marginal savings to reflect the impact that their emissions has on pollution. So if A11 and A21 are both one, then we have our original equation that says MS1 equals MS2 equals the marginal damage. Okay. So, but once we adjust for their marginal, their transfer coefficients, then it's the marginal savings per impacted by their transfer coefficients. So let's consider how that looks. So if we look at firm one, and it says, here's E1, and before, the marginal savings was given by this line MS1. Then if A11 is greater than 1, then we are going to look at MS1 over A11, then the marginal savings has to get smaller. So the bigger A11 is, the further in shifts the marginal savings. So the marginal savings, MS1 divided by A11, shifts in because A11 is greater than 1. Now that should make sense because the marginal damage equals the marginal savings. So we put in the marginal damage. So this says that if it wasn't for the impact of the transfer coefficient, we would be at E1 bar. But since A11 is bigger than 1, 1 unit of emissions does more than 1 unit of damage, then efficiency requires that the firm should be producing less emissions than if A11 is ignored. Okay, and now if A11 is less than 1, then that means that the marginal savings per unit of emissions shifts up, and the firm would be, it would be efficient to allow the firm to have more emissions. Okay. Now, so let's look at an example where we have two firms in one zone. Okay. So we'll let the marginal savings of firm I the identical equal 14 minus 7 EI. I equals 1 to 2. And we will assume that pollution P, and I'm not going to put a subscript J since there's only one zone, equals A1 E1 plus A2 E2. And we'll assume that total damage is equal to 1/2 P squared. So the marginal damage is equal to P. Okay. And further, we will assume that A1 equals 2 and A2 is equal to 3. So how do we solve for the optimal level of emissions? Well, we need to have the condition that the marginal savings of firm 1 over A1 equals the marginal savings of firm 2 over A2 equals the marginal damage of pollution. So if we substitute in, we get 14 minus 7 E1 over 3, over 2, sorry, equals 14 minus 7 E2 over 3. And that equals the marginal damage we said is P. So marginal damage is really 2 times E1 plus 3 times E2. I can put that in. Okay. So now I have the efficiency condition. And to solve this, I break it up into two equations. So the first equation becomes the first equality, 14 minus 7e1 over 2 equals 14 minus 7e2 over 3. And the second equation becomes 14 minus 7e1 over 2 equals 2e1 plus 3e2. And now I simplify these two problems and first cross multiply, and I get 42 minus 21e1 equals 28 minus 14e2. And then I collect terms and I get 14 equals 21e1 minus 14e2. I divide by 7 and I get 2 equals 3e1 minus 2e2. Then I go over the second equation and that becomes 14 minus 7e1 equals 4e1 plus 6e2. Okay, or 14 equals 11e1 minus plus 6e2. So now I have two equations and two unknowns. And I put the two together and I get that solving these two equations gives me E1 will be equal to 1 and E2 equal to 0.5. So even though they have identical marginal savings functions, because firm 2 has a higher transfer coefficient than firm 1, we then have firm 1 producing a greater emissions than firm 2. And our pollution P, which is equal to 2 times E1 plus 3 times E2 is equal to 3.5. Okay. Now, we are going to end our class here, and next class, we will look at two zones in the same type of problem. And that is where we will be looking at using the Kuhn-Tucker model of inequality constraints. So we'll leave it there. Okay. So, okay. And I got a question about the literature review. I will send out an email giving you guys more details about the literature review. That's correct. Okay. Have a good evening.